This is Shirley Bradley, and I'm with Jim Cadline. We're at the Ari Olds Museum. This is May 6th, and we're just going to talk about memories of Rio. And I'm going to start by asking Mr. Cadline a little bit about his own background, where he was born, where he went to school, and that sort of thing.
All right. Well, I was born in Lansing, the Sparrow Hospital, December 16th, 1927. And I started school at the Foster Avenue School out on Foster Avenue in 1932. We moved out to Miller Road in about 1938. And I went through the sixth and seventh grades at the Old North School out on Miller Road. We moved to Eaton Rapids in June 1940, and I went on through high school at Eaton Rapids High School. I graduated in January 1945. While I was in high school, I worked at the A&P store in Eaton Rapids, nights after work and Saturdays. And of course, that was, I graduated during World War II, and at that time, all of the boys coming out of high school went into the service. The draft was on at that time, so all we had to look forward to was the service. So in June 1945, my dad was a timekeeper at Rio at the time, and he said, as long as you're going into the service any day, you ought to quit the A&P store and come over to Rio and work and make a little more money than you're making at the store. And so I came over to Rio, and at that time they were hiring anyone that would come in the front door.
Oh, they were.
So I went in and filled out my application and was hired the same day, and went to work as a timekeeper in the motor plant in June 1945.
And someone trained you, or kind of broke you in on what to do?
Yes, they did. At first they put me with an older timekeeper in the motor plant. I worked with him for two or three weeks, and then they gave me my own department to keep time for.
Well.
And that was the paint department. I kept time for all of the painters. And at that time, the factory was working 24 hours a day, three shifts, 3 8-hour shifts. And I worked the day shift. Seems like we worked from 8 to 4.
Sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the shifts were from 8 to 4 and 4 to 12 and 12 to 8. But there were so many people working there at the time, people coming and going all the time, that people were punching in and out for each other. And, someone would come in and punch in for himself and his friend, and his friend wouldn't show up, but was paid anyway. So,
oh my gosh!
One of the jobs responsibilities of the timekeepers was to at the beginning of the shift go to the time clock where all the time cards were, and make a list of everyone that had punched in, and then you went out through the plant and you had to find them.
Wow.
Make sure that everyone that had punched in was actually there working. And so that was my first experience working at Rio, was keeping track of these timekeepers. And
how long did you do
these,
that?
Painters.
That's interesting. How many people did you catch that really weren't working that day?
Oh, I don't know how many. It really didn't happen too often.
What would you do in a case like that? Call plant protection or something?
No, you just report to the personnel office.
Oh, I see.
They take.
Don't pay him for today, huh?
Yeah, don't pay him for today. He wasn't here.
And how long were you there in the motor department?
That was, not very long. I started in June, and the war ended in August. And when the war ended, all of us were sent home. The plant just shut down.
Oh, it did?
Yeah, it did. In fact, of course, they knew, you know, that the war was coming to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that if we were home when it was announced that the war was over, don't come back into work until you're called.
Oh.
So, and that was the way it was with me. I was home in the afternoon when we knew about it, so I just didn't report back into work. And in the meantime, later that fall, I enlisted in the Navy. I went into service. So when I was called back to work, I was in the service.
Oh.
So.
You said Uncle Sam's got me.
Yeah. But I was in the service for 2 years, and when I came back, when I was discharged, I went back to Rio to work. And of course, I worked there right up until the plant closed in 1975.
Did you go back in timekeeping?
No. When I went back, I went into the, this was in 1947, I went into the service parts stock room. And I worked in the service parts stock room, well, from 47 until I think it was probably about 1951. I was offered a job up in the office, up in the parts department office.
Okay.
So that was my first taste of salary work.
You've been on...
I was on hourly.
Hourly. Do you have any idea, can you remember what you were making on hourly wage there at timekeeping?
Well, I started, when I started timekeeping in 1945, I started at 75 cents an hour. And we went through three steps before you got the top rate. And the top rate was $1.09.
Mm.
So we went from 75 through a couple of steps, and the top rate was $1.09. When I came back in 1947, I don't remember the hourly rate, but I remember my weekly paycheck was $50.
Well, that was pretty good then.
Yeah,
it
was. Yeah, we made $50 a week. Yeah.
Because my mother worked there too, and she finally made 35 a week. And we thought that was
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, they didn't. They didn't give pay increases very often.
They didn't.
No, but you felt secure. You know.
Well, that was worth a lot, wasn't it?
Yeah. Anyone that went to work there, generally planned on being there the rest of their working days.
Retiring from there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you went to Rio the first time, you were a little over 18?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then you were 20 or 21 or something when you came back?
Yeah, I was probably 21 when I came back.
Mm-hmm. And of course, your dad, you said, worked there. Now, was he there too after the war?
No, he wasn't. No, he left, he probably left there in 1946.
Mm. I think.
Yeah, Dad wasn't there very long. He had worked for the state years before, and he worked at Rio just a short time.
I see.
You know, he came in there during the war, and when the war was over, he moved up north. He moved up to Bay City.
Mm.
Yeah, he wasn't there very long.
Well, of course, after the war, there were strikes and there were layoffs and all that kind of thing. Work wasn't real steady for a little while until they got into the contract, I think.
Yeah, but it was... when I went back there in 1947, I had a year and a half of college while I was in the service.
Oh.
And when I went back there in 1947, I planned on working there for a year or so and make a little money, you know, and go back to college, finish college. But that never happened. once I went back, I was there.
You had good employment. And
yeah.
Good. What about benefits?
We had
hospitalization.
Yes, we had hospitalization.
You
Blue
did.
Cross.
Mm-hmm. And Blue Cross.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
great.
You started right out with Blue Cross. That was in the early 50s, I imagine. Mm-hmm.
And let me see, vacation time or overtime?
We were paid time and a half for overtime, anything over 40 hours. And you had to work a year before you were given a week vacation. And it seems like maybe after about 5 years, we were given 2 weeks. But then later on, you know, through the years, that changed. And
did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the time I retired, or by the time the plant closed, we were getting 5 weeks a year.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could space them out? Or?
Mm-hmm. You could take them any time during the year that you wanted. But that was with, I believe we had to have 25 years service
before you were allowed
to. The fifth week.
Mm-hmm. My goodness, nice.
Oh,
though,
yeah,
wasn't it
was nice.
You'd take the whole summer off if you
in
wanted
fact,
to, and deer
well,
hunting season. And
there were some years along toward the end. I was managing the parks department, and I wasn't able to take all of my vacation time. You know, we were just too busy, and we didn't take the full 5 weeks. You took what you could. And
Do you recall working conditions? I'm thinking of safety, things of that sort, cleanliness.
Well, of course, the old working out in the plant, it wasn't the cleanest place to work, but they had, you know, bathrooms, nice facilities to keep yourself clean. But the plant itself, you had old wooden floors, you know, that had been soaked with oil and grease for years. And but we felt at the time that we had real good conditions. You know, we weren't concerned
about
it. You
weren't unhappy about it.
No, we weren't unhappy at all. We were real content with what we had.
Did you live anywhere near the Rio plant when you were a kid growing up?
No.
Or later?
No, I didn't. When I was real young, we lived out on the east side of town, out toward Frandor, out on Francis Avenue. And then we moved out to Miller Road.
Oh, that's right. You did tell me that.
And then from there, Eaton Rapids. So all of the time that I worked at Rio, I lived in Eaton Rapids.
Who do you remember working with? I guess we'll start with the beginning, when you went in for timekeeping, when your dad had you got you in.
Oh, well, Carl Ogden was the head of the time department. He was the man that hired me.
Mm.
And the man I worked with out in the motor plant that trained me, his name was Fay Blackledge.
Blackledge?
Blackledge. Yeah, and I think it seemed like Fay lived in Perry. But then when I moved over to the main assembly building and took over the paint department, I worked with an old-time keeper named John Butler. And I can't think of my own foreman's name, Jerry. Can't think of his last name.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah. But John Butler was in the same little office out in the shop that I was in, and he taught me a lot. You know, he'd been there for years. And
what kind of a timekeeping? Out here in the museum, we've got this, out of the 20s,
mm-hmm.
way before any of
yeah.
us, but we've got this big old timekeeping machine with
mm-hmm.
a big wheel that you turn that
yeah.
punches the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what kind of equipment were you using?
Well, at that time, during the war, there was a little building up on Baker Street, up at the end of Platt Street. And everyone coming into the plant came through that little time clock building.
Oh,
there
okay.
There were rows of time cards and time clocks. And, of course, the departments were all separated on the board that contained all of the time cards. And everyone came through this little building, picked their card out, and punched the clock, and put the card over in another rack. There was a rack for those not in the plant and a rack for those that were at work. So when the timekeeper went into this little time clock building, you just went to the rack of all of the cards that were punched in. And you had a list of everyone that was in your department. And you just went through the cards and checked off everyone that had punched in. And of course, you'd go over to the other side and see who hadn't punched in. And then from there, go on out into the plant and find them, make sure they were there. The painters were, they were scattered all over the plant.
Oh, you know,
there were painters on the final assembly line, and then there were painters in other smaller departments, you know, that were painting.
Paintings, just parts that
yeah,
went onto the
truck. Yeah, just different parts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, now everything's digital, so.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, everything is automatic.
But you know, people still punch in friends, because my son-in-law works at GM, and he's told me about that.
Yeah.
I never directly accused him.
No. Yeah, well, I heard my dad, you know, before I started working at Rio. He worked the midnight shift from 12 to 8 in the morning. And I guess it was more common on that shift.
Oh, on the midnight
for
shift?
For people to punch in and out for each other than it was during the day.
Is that what they called the graveyard shift?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was.
That's interesting because I don't know of any place now that has three shifts anymore, do you?
No.
Of course, war production had to roll out.
Yeah, we worked just straight 8 hours, and they gave us 20 minutes for our lunch halfway through the shift. And then in the middle of the first half and in the middle of the second half of the shift, we had a little break. I don't remember what it was, 5 or 10 minutes.
There was a lunchroom someplace nearby. You didn't have to go clear across the shop?
No,
or you just ate where you were?
No, there wasn't a lunchroom. Most people just ate, you know, right wherever they worked. In fact, I remember just outside of our office there was a big workbench, and these fellows had torches, like welding torches. And they'd set their sandwiches up on the counter, up on the workbench, and they'd toast their sandwiches with their welding torches.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But right across the street from Rio on Baker Street, right across from the motor plant, way down close to Cedar Street.
Close to Cedar.
Was Potter's Restaurant.
Oh.
And these people catered to the employees at Rio. And of course, this was during the daytime. I don't think this happened at night. But they prepared lunches, all easy-to-get kind of things, like goulash and chili and bean soup, things that could be served up real quick. And when our 20 minutes would start, there'd be a mad rush over to Potter's. And they'd serve this, you know, I don't know how many.
Fast as they could.
Yeah, they'd serve them, and we'd be back in 20 minutes, back on your...
I wonder if that building's still staying.
Yeah, the building is still
there. Is it?
Yeah, it's about, probably the second or third door west of Cedar Street, on the south side of Baker Street.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a big old brick building, and it's called Potter's Restaurant.
That's
yeah.
So let's see. The war is over. You're back out of the service, and you're back at work. And so you progressed to different departments, or?
Yes, and that was one thing about Rio. They promoted their own people from within. You know, they would, you know.
Instead of going outside and finding.
Give the better jobs to their own people. You know, if you're qualified for something and the job is open, they would give that to their own people and, you know, take care of their own employees rather than going to the outside. And I was working out in the on this park stock room. I'd been out there for about 5 years, and we, you know, we picked orders and packed orders for shipment and loaded trailers and boxcars and one thing and another.
With parts that were going...
Yeah, these are part shipments going out to real dealers and real branches.
Oh, so the they would be doing repairs and,
yeah,
whatnot.
Yeah,
oh,
and
okay.
All of the real branches and dealers would order all of their parts requirements through, you know, through the parts department. In the stock room that I worked in is where we gathered all the parts and packed them for shipment.
Mm. All over the world, I suppose.
Yes, all over the world. Yeah, they had foreign dealers, and yeah, we shipped many export orders. Yeah. In fact, they had a separate little group that packed export.
Oh, they did?
Because that was packed different, you know, than things going to domestic dealers. All of the export shipments were packed in wooden boxes and crates, and the domestic shipments were in cardboard cartons. And
they weren't going to be handled so roughly,
no,
or had to go such a distance.
No.
That's interesting.
But while I was working out in the stock room, the manager of the parts department office came out to me one day and asked if I'd like to come to work up in the office. And so I went up to the office and sat at his desk, and he interviewed me, you know, and he said, we're offering you this job. You can come up here and have your own desk, and you'll be taking orders from the dealers and branches.
Oh, they would call in or write
they'll,
in?
They'll either call or come in the mail. At that time, a lot of business was done by mail. But there were phone orders, but the main thing I remember that interview is when it was finished, he says, "Now you can have this job if you'd like it, but he says you'll be foolish if you don't take it." So
you said, "Oh, I plan to take
yeah,
it."
Well, I thought that was great anyway. You know
that. So, but was that a pay increase?
Oh yes, that was pay increase. I don't remember how much, but it was a pay increase.
And it was something new to do.
It was something new to do, and a new group of people to work with.
You remember anybody that you worked with there?
I remember about all of them.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, Art Fromm was one of
them.
Oh,
you worked with Art Fromm?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Art was the assistant purchaser for the parts department.
The tapes that we do are stored here at the museum, mm-hmm. And so his is back there. I'm going to have to listen to it again just for fun.
Yeah, Art worked for an old man named Carl Godfrey. Godfrey was the head of service purchasing, and Art Fromm was his assistant.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and the man that I worked for, his name was Judd McLernan.
Judd
McLernan. He was the office manager for McLernan.
And I'm writing these down because when Jim's secretary transcribes this, she's going to say, "How do I spell that?"
Well, it's
maybe it's M C L.
There was two C's in it.
Oh, there were.
M C L E R N A N. I think.
All one word, you think?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was kind of a hyphenated.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, right. I've got it.
But and the head of all service and parts was Peter Hamelink.
Hamelink?
Hamelink. Yeah. H-A-M-E-L-I-N-K, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I've heard the name before various times, I think. I don't remember now the connection, but... And they were all in the department where you were working?
Yeah, we were all in the same one big room.
Mm-hmm. Oh, each had your own desk.
Yeah, we each had our own desk. But this was parts and service both. There were a group of people in there that did service work, you know, with the dealers and branches.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a little group that did parts pricing, made up our price books. We had another group that wrote parts catalogs. And we had a group that handled nothing but military parts.
Oh, sure.
And
It'd be a little different, I suspect.
Yeah, yeah. They bid on all of their work.
Did they?
Because
they had a government contract.
Yeah, yes. They were bidding on military contracts, mm-hmm. government contracts for parts for military trucks.
And all the parts were made in the factory. We didn't have outsourcing then, maybe, or?
Well, we did have some. Yes, we made. All of our frame and sheet metal parts, and we made all of our, we built our own gasoline engines, but they did buy many other parts. They bought their axles and transmissions and clutches, and a lot of the brake and steering parts, steering gears were purchased from the outside.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, there was a lot of material coming in from the outside.
So when you got an order from some dealer halfway across the country, did you then have to get the parts from some of these outsourcing?
Well, no, those parts were already in our warehouse.
Oh, they were. Oh, I see. They just.
Yeah, they're already in our warehouse. And we had a stock records group that, of course, back that time we didn't have computers. Everything was on cards, and it was all done manually. But they kept a record of all parts that were in the stock room.
Mm.
And these, of course, were parts that were manufactured in our plant and parts that were coming in from outside sources. But they had on their stock record for each part, they had a low minimum quantity. And as these girls were posting orders that were coming in for parts, and they would get down to that low quantity, then they would reorder.
Okay. You're so getting low, you ordered more.
Yes, it was... really a manual computer system is what
it sounds like. It worked too.
Oh, it did. It worked good.
Now you said the girls was the office was there was a section where they had
boards
on the wall or something?
No, they were big books. Oh, they were books about this size. And they had a table about not quite this long. And these books were lined up on both sides of this table.
Mm-hmm.
And there were girls on each side. And our part numbering system was an alphabetical system, run from A through Y, I guess it was. I think Y was the last. But these books were set up alphabetically, and the girls on one side had one half of the alphabet, and the girls on the other side had the other half of the alphabet.
Oh, okay.
And of course, every parts order that was entered, there were many copies of the same order.
Oh, you know, triplicate, huh?
Yes, there was a copy that went down to the stock room to pick the stock by, and there was a copy that went with the order to the dealer or whoever it was going to, and there was a copy that went to these posting clerks so that they could post, you know, all of the items on the order. They would post those quantities out of inventory. And that was how they, that was their inventory control system.
Sure. Then those orders would go down to the various departments, or down to the
down
shipping
to the
or wherever,
room.
Down
mm-hmm.
to stock room,
yeah,
and then out
to
shipping or something.
Room. Yeah, yeah, and we had people in the, and every item on each order had a little tag written for each other. And this was all done by hand. There was a lady that did nothing all day long but handwrite little tags for all of these individual parts. But these tags, along with the order, would go down to the stock room, and the people that picked the stock would take the tags, and they'd go around through the stock room and pick all the parts and bring them back to a big checking bench, and there was a checker that would check all of the
against the
parts
order.
Against the order to make sure everything was there, and anything that wasn't there that we didn't have in stock, they would back order, you know, they'd mark on the order to back order it. And
now, did any of the paperwork come back up to your office after the order had been filled?
Yes, it had to come back up to the office for billing.
Oh, of course.
So that it could be billed out to whoever it was going to. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was. It was.
You know, really, it sounds fascinating. All this happening.
It was.
And therefore, a lot of people could have jobs there,
mm-hmm.
where now one computer does the work of, who knows.
Yeah.
So did you stay in that department then on through the rest of your working career?
I was in the parts office from 1951 until probably about 1953. I was given another better job, promotion, and I went into the sales department.
Oh, you did. And what did you do?
And I was an assistant to the sales distribution manager.
And who was that?
His name was Hugh Clark.
Oh, Hugh Clark. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And in that position, it was similar to the old parts department job of taking parts orders. In the sales department, I was taking truck orders.
Now we're doing the whole thing.
Yeah. My job was to take the truck order as it came in from the branch or the dealer, and convert this order into a engineering order that the truck could be built by.
Hmm. Oh, because people had specific needs.
Yes, they did.
These trucks.
I don't know if Rio ever built two trucks the same. You know, they were. All trucks were built specifically for a certain job. And we had a sales engineering department that their main function was to set up specifications for trucks to do whatever the truck was being built to do.
Sure.
And
Mr. Mitchell that I talked to yesterday,
he was in
talked
the,
about that.
Yeah,
about
he was in the engineering department,
mm-hmm.
and the sales department would work closely with the engineering department in setting up these engineering orders to build the trucks by.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you really were part of the whole. And he was remembering that he recalled one particular day when there were, I think, 100 or 110 trucks that were finished and went down the line that day. And he said, that was a big day.
Yeah.
He said, because you have to think, Oldsmobile was doing 110 cars an hour.
An hour.
But he said the trucks were all different. Some were, you know, longer than others. And they don't come down the line as fast. And I thought, that's fascinating. Because now we just, you know, everything's cut out like cookie cutters.
Yeah, they run all the way from trucks that were just a little larger than a pickup truck, all the way up to the big big semi tractor, highway.
Go over the road. And he showed me a picture of, when you said pickup truck, he showed me a picture of something like a pickup truck that was built here. What did he call it? Something Mac, Little Mac.
Oh, Mac Jr.
Mac
Jr., yeah.
And I was so amazed. I hadn't known that they were. I always thought of the big military trucks and the big over-the-road trucks and, you know.
Yeah, well, in the late 30s, Rio did build a pickup truck. And that was what Les was talking about.
Must be.
Mm-hmm.
He had a picture of it.
Yeah, and then
And you mentioned parcel post trucks, or UPS trucks.
Oh, we built many, many. These were big highway tractors for UPS.
Oh, the big thing.
Yeah, they were the big
semi.
Flat front, big square, semi trailer tractors.
Now, would that have that real common engine in it?
No, that had a diesel engine.
A diesel engine.
Yeah, that was a big, much bigger than the real. The real Gold Comet was a gasoline engine.
And this is diesel.
Yeah, and these big highway tractors were diesels. And that had a Cummins diesel engine in it.
Cummins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, in the later years of Diamond Rio, United Parcel Service was one of their biggest customers.
It was?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Because I know, you know, through the last years, things, you know, were boom and bust almost, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Yeah. They were. And they depended a lot on the military contracts. And these military contracts were real good for production, too, because commercial production is... the orders coming in are irregular, you know. You may get a dozen orders today and 100 tomorrow, and they don't come in at a regular rate. So that for the production line, it was real handy for them to have these military contracts to fill a production line on the slow days.
Oh, sure.
You know,
sure.
They didn't have to build a certain number of military trucks each day. They might, run a half a dozen today and 40 tomorrow. But they were real good to fill in these gaps.
Oh, yes. I can see that.
In the,
so otherwise, you'd be sending people
production.
Home after 2 or 3 hours of work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah, and they would... of course, there were... people that made up the lineups every day for production, and they would make these lineups up based on the age of the truck order that had come in and the availability of material in the plant to build the trucks.
Mm.
And as they made this lineup up each day, if they had gaps in the lineup, you could stick military trucks in there and keep a steady flow.
Keep production going.
For the production line, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you stay in that sales department then?
I was in that department about 4 years. And we had a slow time in the economy and production. This was in about 1957. And I went back into the parts department. The sales department cut back on the number of people. And.
Mm.
So I went back into the parts department as a parts catalog writer. And I wrote parts catalog material for probably about 4 years. And by this time, White Motor had bought Rio.
Did that make a change in what you were doing?
And no, not in what I was doing. Speeded up what we were doing. It added people to our department because of we started building at this time we were building trucks for Rio and Diamond T and White, and it just meant enlarging the department. And the man that I worked for, that was the head of the parts catalog group, his name was Mike McGivern. He was moved down to Cleveland to take over the White Motor parts catalog operation, and I was promoted into his job. I was given the job as head of the parts catalog group.
Now, was that another pay increase for you?
Oh yes,
great.
That was another promotion.
Well, you got to go home and say, guess what?
And but things were. Things were getting busier for us. You know, we were now we weren't just writing parts catalogs for reels. We were writing parts catalogs for Diamond Tees and for Whites. And the product line was increasing, you know, they were adding new models, and this parts catalog business was...
And that was all done by hand, I guess?
It was all done by hand, yes, it was done by hand.
Take me through an order or a day that what you're doing in this parts catalog.
Well, they had what they called I'm thinking of what the engineering department called their bills of material. These were the bills of material that trucks were built by. And our parts catalogs were written based on the engineering orders or engineering bills of material, because we're servicing the trucks with the same parts that go into the trucks when they're being built. So we would take the engineering bills of material for each model, and from these bills of material would take the list of the part numbers for, well, all the parts to build an engine, for example.
Okay.
And we would write a engine section for our parts catalog based on these engineering bills of material. And from there, or beyond this, we would write to all of our suppliers, the people that build our transmissions and clutches and axles and, you know, springs and all of the material brought in from the outside, all of the assemblies brought in from the outside. We would get the bills of material from our suppliers, for example, of a transmission. And we would have a parts catalog section for this particular transmission, and eventually every transmission that was used in our production. So we went from originally having two people in the parts catalog department to maybe 20 of us.
Oh my.
And
well, it was a lot of work.
Yeah, we had certain people that wrote the parts list for the all of the sheet metal, you know, the cabs, the hoods, the fenders, and this sort of thing. And someone would work on nothing but transmissions, and someone would work on axles. And
like specialty.
Yeah, it was.
Did they ever send you out around the shop? I mean...
Well, we were out in the shop all the time.
You weren't just stuck in your office?
Yeah, no, we were out in the shop. You know, we'd be writing a parts catalog section on maybe battery boxes or fuel tanks. And we'd have a bill of material that listed all of these parts. But from this, you couldn't tell exactly how all of this went together. So you'd go out in the shop where they were actually...
Oh, and watch them do it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So then you really had a visual picture of what you were...
Yeah, that... writing parts catalogs was the best education that anyone could have.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Because you learned what was really going on.
You learned everything that was internal and everything that went in the truck. You know, you learned all of the parts of the engine and how it operated, and all of the parts of the transmissions and how they operated. And
Yeah,
you...
That would be an education,
wouldn't
it?
Oh, it was real interesting.
Because I have no idea what goes on under a hood.
Well, most of us didn't when we started.
No, you have to see it done or do it or something.
Yeah.
So did you stay then in the...
I stayed in the parts catalog department. I started in the parts catalog department in, I think, about 57, and then I took over as manager, I think, about 61. And then when Diamond Reel was formed out of Reel and Diamond T, this is in about 1967, I was made general parts manager.
Mm.
I was given the responsibility of the whole parts department, which included well, our parts cataloging and our parts pricing. And we had a group of field representatives that traveled the country merchandising parts through all of our dealers.
And so that was all.
That was all.
All under your responsibility. So did you stay in there and that in doing that
I was doing that right up until
the end.
The plant closed. Yeah.
Did you see it coming?
Yes.
You must have doing all the work you did.
Yeah. You could feel it coming. You didn't want to admit, I guess, that it was coming, but everyone had that feeling. That
you did. You didn't know for sure how long this was going to last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was a real bad feeling, too.
Oh, it must have been.
You know, White sold Diamond Reel. I don't remember when that was. Sold that to Francis Cappert, and shortly after that, it wasn't, you know, within a couple of years, we could see things changing.
You could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they seemed like the structure of the company changed after White sold to this Mr. Cappert. You didn't have a big corporation, you know, behind.
You didn't have.
I'd like to add, I guess, is that just Reel just wasn't a place to work. It was the main part of our social life.
Well, and good. I'm glad you're getting to that. Yeah.
We had the girls had their girls' club. And the salaried men had their own club, the Steering Gear Club. We had our club room upstairs in the clubhouse. We'd have a meeting once a month. We'd go up there and play cards and have a good meal and quite often have a speaker. And once in a while, rather than having a meeting, we'd go to Detroit to a football game or to a baseball game or go to Michigan State to a football game. We had something going on every month. We had a golf league, and both the men and the women had a bowling league. And
because the bowling alleys were in the clubhouse?
Yeah, well...
Or did you go out?
Yeah, they went out at the time. I guess years before, they did have bowling alleys in the basement.
And probably they weren't
what
you could use later.
But during our years there, the old bowling alley was our printing department. downstairs. But we had our own cafeteria in the basement of the clubhouse.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. But there were family things going on all the time too. They used to have the Reel Fall Fair.
What was that?
And this was it was just like a county fair. It was where employees brought their hobbies, and some of them had animals there.
What a great place to take the kids.
And the kids were a part of it. They had a Christmas party each year for the kids. All of the families brought their kids, and they had gifts for, you know, different age groups, and kids got to know each other, and husbands and wives got to know each other. We had had a big Christmas party. It was called the Charity Ball every year in the clubhouse.
Mm.
They'd have a band come in, and we'd all get together there and drink and dance and
have a good
you
time.
Know, just
and money,
have a real
the
good.
Money went to charity or something?
Yeah.
You said you called up the charity
ball?
Yeah,
it was charity
to do things
ball.
In the community.
Yeah.
What and, I've heard about the Red Stocking Club too for Christmas, where they would fill.
Oh yes, that was. I think that was a Lansing City.
Oh, that was a citywide thing,
but,
not just
but
a real
Rio
thing.
Was involved in it, the same as okay. the old Newsboys.
Okay.
People from Rio would take part in that. They'd come through the offices selling the old Newsboys papers, but. Families got to know each other, and many of our closest friends today are old Rio people, you know, people from back in the Rio days. And
you forged that bond.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get together with several people from Rio.
Good. That's wonderful.
Yeah, get together with them in Florida and get together with them up here.
What a loss then when that yeah. door closed and the lock
yeah.
was turned.
Uh-huh. And that we have a
mercy.
We have a real reunion every year
mm-hmm.
now. And these people get together and it's just like an old family reunion, you know. They're all hugs and
yeah.
it's just like a family thing.
Well, it really was a family
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, it was.
And I don't mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever heard of that happening anywhere else, really.
No.
And I just can't imagine how shattered everybody must have felt
yeah. Yeah.
there in 1975.
Yeah.
One of the ladies I talked to a few years back said she didn't know for sure. You know, like
mm-hmm.
you said, you kind of had a feeling, but you mm-hmm. kind of pushed that thought away. But when she went into work and the doors were padlocked on the office building,
yeah. mm-hmm.
she said she just sat down and cried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You worked after the closure.
Yeah, I stayed. I worked for the liquidating company.
Oh, you did?
For a year after the company closed.
Because you knew about records and inventories and things, I suspect.
Well, yes, being... that associated with the parts department, you know, and we had this company through the bankruptcy court bought the total inventory of the company, both the service and production inventories.
Everything inside the balls.
Yes,
oh, okay.
everything.
Okay.
And everything except the equipment in the plant.
Oh,
and
not the equipment.
No, they didn't buy the equipment. They just bought the parts from the parts department, or that were in the parts department, and the production inventory, what was left over, you know, to build.
Were there
trucks.
Things half finished, I wonder, coming down
well,
the line?
Well, there were many trucks half finished. Down here behind, the old duplex building. Down on the corner of Mount Hope and Washington.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
On down behind that, down toward the
south.
The National Guard Armory down
mm-hmm.
in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big empty lot down in there, and that was full of partially built trucks.
What happened to them?
And well, they were sold, and Will Johnson, he had been a sales manager years before. Will was given the job of disposing of that truck inventory. And I imagine they were sold to former Diamond Rio dealers.
Oh.
And, you know, they probably completed them on their own. And, but there were, that lot was full of trucks that were just partially built. And
but
that,
your job then was to work with this liquidating, or this stuff?
I worked for this liquidating company selling off inventory.
What, did you have to find buyers? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just used the telephone and found buyers. Through this bankruptcy, a company in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania bought the rights to the Diamond Reel name and bought all of the engineering. They bought the engineering and production rights through the bankruptcy court, and they continued to build Diamond Reels in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania for some time, for several years. And a lot of that inventory was sold to them.
I see. And that took a couple of years, you said?
Well, I worked there for a year.
A year.
And it was pretty much finished up when I left.
It had to be odd going into that place.
Oh, it was.
With it quiet and everybody gone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the plant was just dead. Nothing. It was just dead. We walked through there with flashlights.
Did very many other people have a year employment after, like you did?
Yeah, there were several of us there. There was probably...
They had to wrap it up, huh?
Yeah, there was probably, 10 or 12 of us that that worked there for this company. Tom Shelley and Dwayne Eller, who had been a part of Diamond Reel, headed this company, this liquidating company, and I think as a result of this company following the liquidating company disposing of the inventory, I think Tom Shelley started that nuts and bolts store down on
South
Cedar.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So whatever was left over, I think
Tom Shelley
took into that nuts and bolts
store.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. In fact, there was a couple of other little offices in that building engraving.
Yeah.
Did you say Tom Shelley?
Shelley.
Okay.
Yeah. Years before, that old building was a part of Rio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Way back. In the passenger car days.
When they had that...
The tramway.
Tram across the Cedar Street.
Where
the cars were pushed
mm-hmm.
across. And then Nash Kelvinator was there during the war,
yeah, they
I
were.
Remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I guess John Bean went in there.
Oh, that's right.
Later, didn't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, they did. Maybe it was the other way around.
No,
sure, but anyway.
Probably Nash Kelvinator first.
First, you think, mm-hmm. and then John Bean.
Yeah, and then John Bean.
They made
Bean.
Firefighting mm-hmm. equipment and
yeah.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. So, let's see here. I guess we've kind of skirted around
yeah.
it, but your impressions of Rio Motor Car Company as you look back, when you think about it?
Well...
A good time, a sad time.
Yes, when I look back, at the years that I was there and the people I worked with and the jobs that I had while I was there and the times that we had, the social end of it, the friends that I have yet from... Even though the company wound up going through bankruptcy, I don't think I would have done anything any different. I look back and I think there was a time in the 50s when things were real slow at Rio. I was still working out in the shop, out in the parts warehouse. I was laid off. And... I went to work over at Oldsmobile, and they put me in the small press room over there. This was, it was probably around 1950.
Mm.
And I worked in that press room over there for 6 weeks, And I was called back to Rio, and I was never so happy in my life, you know, to get back to Rio. But I think back and think, retirement-wise, how much better off I would have been if I had stayed at Oldsmobile.
Mm-hmm.
But there
wasn't any retirement from...
From Rio?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, in June 1975, I had my 30 years in. And it was shortly after that, along in the fall, July or August, they called me up to the personnel department, and they knew that I had enough time to retire, you know, 30 years. And they called me up and they said, "We think that the company is near the end. And just for your sake, you know, safety's sake, we think it would be better for you to retire right now than to wait and see what happens afterwards." So I took retirement, and at the same time I took retirement, I hired back as a temporary employee to work on up until I closed the doors. But anyway, we were given $550 a month plus our benefits when we retired.
Mm-hmm.
And was within a year or so after that. When the company went through bankruptcy, we lost our benefits right there. But we drew the $550 a month for maybe a year, and then it was reduced down. I think it was like $270 a month that I collected for a few years after that, maybe three or four years. And then I had a letter one day from Pension Benefit Guarantee, which was making our retirement payments in, telling me that that my benefit was being reduced from $270 or whatever it was down to $62 a month. And that's what I get right now for 30 years of service.
For all that work and loyalty.
60. But I went out to the General Motors parts plant in 1976 when I left this liquidating company, and was able to work 15 years out at the GM parts plant.
Okay.
And
I wondered.
Yeah,
I figure you were too young then.
Yeah, that's really. Yes, I was only 48 when. I had my 30 years, and I was 48 years old.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing. Yeah. Oh no.
So if it, in the end, if it hadn't been for General Motors, we would have been in pretty sad shape. And I was lucky too. Back at that time, I was one of the younger people there, and these fellows that were older than I was, you know, they weren't able to find work.
Yeah, I've heard some stories about a couple of suicides, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it was so devastating.
Mm-hmm. It was. It was. That was just taking our whole life away from us.
You still have one boy at home.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people around the shops and the restaurants and whatever around the Rio, they must have been affected too, because, you said, the Potter's lunchroom depended on you guys.
That whole little
drugstore and grocery store.
Business section there in South Lansing. Yeah, that little bank on the corner there.
Yes.
What is that?
I remember that bank. Was it American State then?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Right across from the depot.
Yeah, we'd run up there every Friday and cash our checks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a busy place. And the, what was the old restaurant there on the corner, right across the corner from it?
There was one, wasn't there?
Yeah, we'd go up there quite often.
It's lost in here somewhere.
Yeah,
but I do remember that.
Yeah.
And then down a ways was Larrabee Sports Shop, I think, mm-hmm. and Lansing Recreation where the bowling was.
Yeah, the bowling alley. And on down the other
Wimpy's
way.
Wimpy's or something, the yeah, same for hamburgers.
Yeah. And on down the other way was Maria's. Remember Maria's restaurant?
Yes.
That guy I worked for when I was timekeeper, Jerry, his name was Jerry Lutz.
Jerry Lewis?
Lutz.
Lutz.
L-U-T-Z.
L-U-T-Z.
Yeah, Jerry Lutz.
I knew it would come back to you.
Yeah, well, I knew it. I just... But everybody that worked at Rio had pride in what Rio was building, too.
That's an important thing.
You know, I've never talked with a person that owned a real car or a real truck, and we talked with a lot of truckers, you know, in later years when we were traveling the country.
Oh, is that so?
I've never talked with any of them that didn't say their car or their truck was the best. You know, some old real car owner, well, that was the best car I ever owned. And
do you think, looking back, that there could have been a way to go on that didn't have to close?
Well, there might have been, but in fact, within that last few years, there was some talk of building a new real plant.
Hmm.
And I remember real management people going out on way out North Wood Street, looking at property out there.
Oh, really?
But for Rio to survive, they would have had to have had a new plant.
Because it was getting very old,
yeah,
wasn't it?
It was getting old and it was outdated. You know, technology had...
Machinery too, maybe?
Yeah. But as far as their product was concerned, though, they had a tremendous product line. And they had a real good dealer organization. Everything was there.
Everything was in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just needed money to...
Just needed the facility to...
And some of the bad
things. Yeah, to produce.
Mm.
And this, you know, the individual that owned the company just... wasn't strong enough, you know, didn't have the finances and, you know.
Sounds like he wasn't really interested only as a financial.
Yeah, that's been kind of a question ever since, you know. Was this done on purpose or not? No mm-hmm. one knows.
No one knows. What did you think when they bulldozed the clubhouse down?
Oh, I was sick. Yeah, that was a nice building.
Yes, it was.
That was a real nice building, and I don't know why the city didn't do something to preserve that.
Well, yeah. I understand that it was on the National Historic Register for a while.
Yeah, it could have
and
been.
There was a loophole found
mm-hmm.
temporarily, and then it was too late.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not. It's just a rumor, like everything.
Yeah. No, that was a nice building. And we had so many activities there in that building. We used to have, with the Steering Gear Club, we'd have speakers come in. We had a sports night every year. And I remember one night, they had... Biggie Munn from Michigan State and Bump Elliott from Michigan. They were the two speakers.
Oh, that had to be fun.
Yeah, that was.
It had to be a great night.
Kind of went at each other, you know, a little bit. But they were both good sports about
it. Sure.
You know, those things were fun. And you think of those things when you think of the clubhouse. One sports night, they had Gordie Howe.
Oh,
from the Red Wings.
Yes,
he was the speaker.
Oh, that had to be interesting.
Yeah, it was.
So it was a special place.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that clubhouse was special. Well, that's where we had all the Christmas parties for the kids.
That's where all the social.
Yeah, and
you had one movie star get a truck here too, Mark.
Dale Robertson.
Dale Robertson.
He had a special, some special trucks built.
Yes.
What was that, in the 60s?
I imagine it was. Mm. Yeah, your dad was still working. He met him, didn't he?
My dad used to cut
cabs. Well, her dad was the one that put the cabs down onto the.
Your dad worked at Rio.
Trains, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When did he work there?
Well, he worked there 45 years and he retired in the 60s. The doctor came in.
Well, I don't know, but he must have started there back around the end of World War I.
Yeah, he didn't get in the war because he got out of the street.
He lost a finger.
That's the only thing kept
on the job.
No.
No. He didn't get in the war because he'd lost the end of his finger.
Yeah.
I got you now.
His trigger finger.
Oh, his trigger finger.
Yeah.
Might need that.
Yeah, then he died.
But he worked there for 40 years, and he put the truck bodies on the chassis?
He put the cab on the...
The cab.
Yeah, I remember one time, this was back before I went up into the office to work, so it would have been in the late 40s. I used to go out the door on the end of Flat Street, up on Baker Street, right next to where the old-time clocks were.
Okay.
And... I changed off driving with some other people, and I sat there waiting for my ride one night, and the press room was right over just west of us there, toward
Washington
Avenue. And a couple fellows come running up out of the press room, and one guy had the other guy's hand. And they run out the door and was going down just west of us. There was the little hospital. And nurse's station. The guy had cut his finger off back in the classroom. talking about your dad's finger made me think of that. But gosh, here they come running by, and you mentioned safety. There at one time, so apparently they didn't have all the safety devices on
all the
their
hand guards or
machinery
something.
That they do today.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I was going to ask if you had seen any accidents, and then I didn't. And I also quite often ask if you can remember humorous things that happened, and I think you've already shared some with me.
You want to tell about the guys playing euchre at noon?
Well, they. isn't really humorous, I guess, but this building that our part stock room was in was opposite the depot. It was right out next to the railroad tracks, opposite the depot.
Oh, sure, on the north
side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on the north side, and we were up on the second floor, and we could go out of our windows onto the roof that was over the docks down below, the
mm-hmm.
rail docks. They'd bring rail cars up to these docks. Well, there was a metal roof over the rail dock. And in the summer, we'd take our lunch and go out and sit on that roof, you know, and watch the people over at the depot. And now and then a train would come through. And that was... You know, something that you remember.
Sure, that was fun.
Yeah,
get
was.
Out in the fresh air for a few minutes.
Yeah, sit out there and watch mm-hmm. the people at the depot and watch mm-hmm. the old steam engines come through.
Oh, that used to be, I love trains.
Yeah, I like to hear the old train whistles.
Oh, I do too. And there's talk of trying to revitalize that end of town. They're calling it Rio Town, and it should
mm-hmm.
be. Have you seen the mural? Were you there when you dedicated?
Yes, we were there.
We were too.
Yeah, we were there for the dedication.
And wasn't it cold?
Oh, God.
I was so glad to get into
that wind.
The old bowling alley, just to get in out of the wind.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of wind this year. Well, is there anything else you can think of that we haven't covered?
I can't think of anything that we haven't.
Well, I thank you
about.
So much for putting your memories down on this tape for people to listen to later on.